What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care. So sit back, relax, and defocus.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Defocus Media Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Lyerly, and I've got my good friend, Daryl Glover, here with us again today. We're interviewing three of the biggest eye care celebrities today. We've got the Dry Eye Divas. These women are really changing grounds for us as far as optometry and ophthalmology in the cosmetics and dry eye space. Please welcome to the show, this is Amy Gallant Sullivan, Dr. Leslie Odell, and Dr. Laura Perriman. So ladies, tell us a little bit about yourselves and your background in eye care.
Hi, this is Amy Gallant Sullivan, Executive Director of TFOS, or formerly known as the Tear Film and Ocular Surface Society. I actually was the one that began to recruit the divas, and we'll tell you about that in a little bit. But Leslie?
I'm Leslie Odell, an optometrist in Pennsylvania that has a strong interest in dry eye. Recently started the Dry Eye Center of Pennsylvania within an existing optometric practice. And then we also have Laura.
Hi, I'm Laura Perriman. I'm an ophthalmologist in the Seattle, Washington area, and I'm the newest member of the Dry Divas. A really rewarding collaboration.
Thank you, ladies. And I must admit, I really love your name. Dry Eye Divas is priceless. You know, my wife is a diva, so I know you add that with dry eyes, you have something special going on. So let's talk a little bit more about the brand, the name. What's your goals of the Dry Eye Divas? Can you give us a little more background?
All right, Daryl. This is Amy again. So we actually came up with the Dry Eye Divas when we finally got the troupe together for the first time to decide what on earth was going on with our mission. So a couple of years ago, back in 2015, I was actually speaking with Leslie and mentioned how I would love to do some more formal work about education about cosmetics and dry eye or cosmetics and ocular surface disease with TFOS. And I asked her if she would be interested in collaborating on something because obviously she is a dry eye specialist and she's also part of the TFOS Dues 2, which we'll tell you about in a little bit. But since we were already collaborating, I thought it would be great to develop that to another subject area. So Leslie suggested Laura get involved as well. And I was also recommended Laura by someone else, a very well-known dry eye specialist in the US as well, in fact. And so we recruited Laura in at the beginning of 2016. So the Dry Eye Diva concept came together because the three of us were all very interested in dry eye education and helping patients understand how to best not only manage their dry eye, but how they can be beautiful while they're doing it.
So Amy, you're the executive director of the Tear Film and Ocular Surface Society. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in 2017 with this group, because it seems like it's going to be a pretty big year.
Yes. Well, the fun thing about the Tear Film and Ocular Surface Society, or how we prefer to call it, is TFOS, because it's much easier, especially with social media and remembering the name. But so with TFOS, we have this massive global collaboration happening at the moment called the Dry Eye Workshop. And 10 years ago, we had about 80 experts coming together from around the world who published a report on dry eye itself, the classification, the definition, the management, and therapy. So 10 years later, 2017, we thought it would be great to do an update. So for the last 2 years, we have had an initiative involving 150 specialists from around the world on this project. So the report itself is going to be published in May, simultaneously with a special interest group meeting that we will be presenting at ARVO. And this is, again, it's a global undertaking. It's redefining dry eye and the disease, the management, the treatments, and where do we go from there. And I also must interject that Leslie is on one of the subcommittees of the Dry Eye Workshop, and we unfortunately did not yet know Laura. So Laura is not officially part of TFOS Dues 2, but we have engaged her with TFOS, and she's a very, very active member with us. So obviously moving forward, we'll be doing a lot. So for 2017, we'll be publishing the TFOS Dues 2, as well as presenting the findings all around the world. And we'll also be putting together some formal guidelines from the Dry Eye Divas about about cosmetics and ocular surface disease.
What I think is important to add is that this TFOS DOES initiative that happened 10 years ago really changed the way that we treat and manage our patients. And I think that just getting the report updated and out there to the masses is going to help. There's still some doctors and maybe, you know, your listeners that maybe don't know what that is. And Amy, just tell them a little bit about the website, just to how to get involved.
Yes, absolutely. So TFOS is a nonprofit organization. Our URL is tearfilm.org. So just as it sounds, tearfilm as the front of the eye. And we are an international nonprofit organization. We've been around pretty much since 1992. Membership is free. And our objective is really to bring together everyone and anyone that has any interest in anything related to the front of the eye. We bring together MDs and ODs, PhDs, students, inventors, investors, industry, and now also patients, because our mission is to educate. So it's great because we get people together from all around the world to help not only in the workshops, but collaborate on lots of projects that can help educate people worldwide about the findings in ocular surface disease, what are the unmet needs, and how we can help different people, whether it be the doctors and understanding the diseases or the patients and understanding their situation. And I don't want to turn this into a full TFOS call, but there's a lot going on and we would love to get everyone involved somehow. So it would be great to go on our website, which we're currently in the process of updating, but we can still sign up for membership and we'll get more information. So it's tearfilm.org or follow us on Twitter and the handle is iPeople, I-E-Y-E-P-P-L. And it would be great to get to know you better and welcome you into the TFOS community.
So Amy, is it that easy? We just reach out to you via email or social media and we can join the movement. Are there any prerequisites needed to join this community?
It doesn't matter what age you are, what level you are in your career, whether you're a student, whether you've been practicing for 10 years, 20 years, whether you're an optometrist, an MD, PhD, basic science, what have you, we bring everyone together and it's really important to collaborate to get the message out there and to educate people so we can better understand the ocular surface diseases. And Leslie's been able to see a lot of that collaboration being part of the Dry Eye Workshop, actually. It is quite an undertaking when you bring people together from around the world, from all different backgrounds and trainings.
One of my favorite conferences is right around the corner, the Vision Expo in NYC, and I've signed up for several dry eye courses. What is it like to attend an International Tear Film Ocular Society conference? Can you break it down and give me more insight? I mean, I'm pretty sure it's like rock stars of dry eye there.
Yes. Well, it's pretty fantastic because, first of all, we only organize the conference at this time. We only organize it every 3 years. So the most recent conference was last year, 2016, in southern France. And the cool thing about the TFOS conference is we quarantine everyone together for, say, 4 days. And it's really, really intense. So we start in the morning and we go all day. And we have everybody in one general session. So you don't have breakout sessions where you lose anyone. So again, you have the MDs and ODs and PhDs all sitting in the same room together. And it is fabulous because it's very interactive. Again, we really stress collaboration and people get to interact with each other. It's fabulous for networking as well. So people can't feel intimidated that they're only a junior specialist and they have this senior KOL up on stage. And I told Laura the other day that she really needs to come to the next TFOS meeting so she can meet one of her heroes, Dr. Christophe Baudouin in Paris, who's been a part of TFOS for a while. But it's really fantastic because we bring all these doctors in from around the world and everybody gets to be together and they get to ask each other questions and they help a lot. And it's really fantastic too, because this year we started, this last conference, we also had a pitch night for startups. So we help a lot of startups get going and get out there in the market. So we had a pitch night and we'll be doing a lot more of that. So it shows that everyone really needs to work together. And ideally in the future, we'll be doing a lot more smaller meetings. And that's something that we'll be announcing soon because we're launching a global ambassador program. So people can be a lot more involved on a regular basis and they don't have to wait 3 years to get everyone together and meet. It's sort of like a summer camp feeling because once people get involved in the TFOS conference, they just want another one. They say, let's do it. So we're in the process of organizing more. So stay tuned, sign up.
Okay, dry eye. eyes in France, I was sold from that. So I have to make it at some point in time in my life.
Well, we rotate too. It's not just France. So all over the world.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, wow. Very nice.
So I think what they really have helped me realize is that if you share a common interest with your colleagues, whether they're MDs, ODs, industry people, researchers, that really that's all you need. That's the bond that connects you. And it doesn't make you, you know, you're kind of viewed as equals, I feel like, in these settings.
Yeah, it's true what Leslie said. It's really good to have people involved together because they feel like equals. And you can't, we make sure that people don't feel intimidated. We really want everyone to collaborate. And it really helps in a career.
So on the topic of collaboration, I wanted to applaud, I mean, the Tear Film and Ocular Surface Society really does a great job of bringing multiple professions together. It's optometry, it's ophthalmology. One of those big keys eluding us in our profession is how do we better work together? And you guys are doing it great.
Oh, yes. First of all, I learned something from one of my yoga instructors. She said before every session, check your ego at the door. It's really interesting with TFOS because, again, we have MDs, ODs, PhDs, and many other people involved in the organization. And we understand that people have dedicated many years of their life to training and improving their profession, developing their profession and making their specialty what it is today. But we also say, you know, just like when you were in kindergarten, everybody needs to share. Everyone needs to play nicely and play together in the sandbox. And we really want people to understand that. And we understand that some people feel as though that they've had several more years of training and they can do surgery. And so therefore, they may know something better. And then somebody else may say, well, my practice is really important. Truthfully, for TFOS, everybody is important, very important, because everybody has a different experience. Everybody sees patients, but everybody sees things differently with their patients. And it's important for everybody to share their stories and their experience, whatever their title or titles are. And for us, that's what makes it even more enriching, because everybody does have such a diverse background. And also because it's an international playing field, you have so many different perspectives. And it's really incredible to help us, shall we say, focus on what's important. And that's the education. So we really try to check those egos at the door and say, you know, you're all great. That's why we're all here together. And that's why we're going to work together to make this happen. And so that's what we try to do.
That's really exciting. I know for a lot of, we have a ton of student and new grad listeners, dry eye as a specialty can bring your community together. It's not something that's going to make the community opposed to each other or more segregated. So, and that's very exciting for our future.
I think that's totally correct. There's room for everybody. We're talking about a disease state that, when you look at the prevalence numbers, absolutely dwarfs other ophthalmologic diseases. You know, we did 3 million cataracts in the U.S. last year. There's about 2 to 3 million patients with active glaucoma in the United States. The prevalence estimates for dry eye disease starts at 35 million. And some estimates go as high as 55 million just in our country. So this is a hugely underserved problem. There's a lot of opportunity for growth. There's a lot of unmet need in satisfactory treatments. And that's yet another area where collaboration and teamwork can make a big difference for people.
And also what's interesting about dry eye is that it doesn't discriminate in age, where some of the other eye diseases, say glaucoma, is something that's typically for the more aging population, whereas dry eye can impact children. And as we're all aware, we're seeing a much larger prevalence now, whether it be because of tech usage, your phone, your tablet, your computer, or children wearing contact lenses, or children or teenagers using acne medication, or cosmetics. But dry eye is impacting people at every age. So it's something that everyone really needs to address. And I think it's really great to bring everyone together at every age and every level and every background to collaborate and make it known that we really do need to do something about this.
So I want to talk a little bit about Daryl's favorite topic, cosmetics.
Jade, you just took the words out of my mouth. I was about to just mention that. It's funny that you mentioned that, Jen, because I actually just read an article that Dr. O'Dell had written, and it actually painted a beautiful picture for me. It was she was mentioning a student in high school and a dead frog floating in a jar of formaldehyde, and mentioning that, you know, that's what's used as a preservative in most makeup. And when I thought about that, I was like, man, that's crazy. That's like the perfect example to tell all my patients. So Dr. O'Dell, please share with me information about cosmetics?
This is where the collaboration of the Dry Eye Divas has really been a big learning curve for me. I learned so much this year from working with Amy and Laura, and really all of the articles that you read, and even that one, actually, the frog analogy, Daryl, really comes from Amy. She's got quite a way of words. And so I've been really learning a lot about her analogies, and I've used them for my own patients as well. But really what I found frustrating was a few years ago, I was listening to an audio cassette, because I was doing podcasts, I guess, before podcasts were cool. And so on my way to work, I would listen to an audio tape of a ophthalmology lecture or something like that. And it was the first time I ever actually heard anyone talk about cosmetics and just some of the tips they gave their patients. And up until that point, I had seen so many patients that said, my doctor told me to stop wearing makeup because I have dry eye. And being a woman and wearing makeup myself, I thought, well, this is just not acceptable. And so just learning about the ingredients that are in the cosmetic, what they have as far as risks to the ocular surface, ones that we know and ones that we assume, you know, could be harmful to the ocular surface, we can really help our patient reduce their toxin load, reduce the ocular surface offenders, and be able to hopefully maintain good ocular health while they're wearing their cosmetics. And it's really scary how unregulated this area is. And that's the one thing I didn't realize. So in our country, there's only 11 banned chemicals that go into cosmetics of any kind, whether it's shampoo, lotion, cosmetics that we think of as far as mascara, eyeliners, eyeshadow. But in European Union, there's 1,300 banned ingredients. So what's going into our products? You know, what makes sense to go into the products? What makes sense to go, you know, in and around the eye? It really is something that we need to keep looking hard at and helping our patients really decode the labels on their products.
If I could add on to that, I think it's important to point out that this is not a problem restricted to females. One of my best friends from medical school has suffered with dry eye for 20 some years. And I finally started asking him, this is something that I've been interested in for a long time. I'm like, hey, you know what? Send me a picture of what you're using for your skincare. And lo and behold, everything that he was using was completely ocular surface unfriendly. I'm like, let's full stop. I want you to put all of that in a box and put it away. We're going to start fresh. And one at a time with very thoughtful ingredients, because everything that you're using is actually making the problem worse. And so, Daryl, I don't want you to feel left out. There's some good news in this for you as well.
No, it's true also now, because a lot of men are using products, even anti-aging products. And I'm not just going to limit it to the metrosexuals in New York either. There are a lot of men out there that use wipes for their eyes. They use face wash. They use creams. So it's definitely, again, it's not discriminating. So everyone has to know what products they're putting on their face and near their eyes. And it's great with having Laura, because with her chemistry knowledge, I know I'm blown away. Leslie, I'm sure you are too. Some of the things that she teaches us about what these chemicals do, it's just, it's phenomenal that cosmetic companies really can put some of these ingredients in a bottle. And again, going back to what Leslie said, it's very much questioning, or should we say worrying, that the U.S. does only block so few chemicals versus Europe that has over 1,000. Again, 11 ingredients versus 1,300 ingredients. Something's up. Something's suspicious. We need to know what's going on.
Well, part of that fault is that our cosmetic laws haven't been updated since 1938. There's been several attempts at updating them, but this law starts from 1938, and it started because someone used a hair dye on their eyebrows and they gave themselves an alkali corneal injury and went blind. So that was what started the FDA Cosmetics Act of 1938. And it hasn't been updated since. And I think it's a huge missed opportunity for consumer safety and patient education.
So us as eye care professionals, are we at fault for this? Should we be fighting more, giving more public awareness about all these issues with these products?
That's what we're doing. Or we're trying to do anyway. Well, there's been several attempts to update the law, but it's failed in our dysfunctional Congress. That's a whole sidebar discussion, but there's been attempts. I'm wondering if maybe there's opportunity or room for our own adverse event repository, develop this large conglomeration of observations about adverse events, and then submit that as a group, as a cohort, I'm just thinking out loud. Because I feel like, yes, there is a mechanism for reporting adverse events, but there's not a mechanism for investigating, exploring, or enforcing consequences of adverse events. It's meaningful in a cosmetics industry. For example, we're seeing a proliferation of lash high growth serums products over the counters that contain a certain ingredient that the FDA has warned them about repeatedly, and yet they continue to use it. The drug I'm talking about is a mouthful, isopropyl clomprostate, and it is a synthetic prostaglandin. So here they are using something that has the same side effect profile as the prostaglandins we use in glaucoma medications, but they're OTC, and so they're using something that really should be cleared by the Drug Administration that falls under the cosmetic umbrella, and we see complications from it.
Well, one thing that TFOS is going to be doing, this is where the Dry Divas are stepping in, we are going to be putting together a handout of guidelines for not only for doctors so they know which ingredients, for example, they should ask their patients about and look at, but also for patients so they should know, they can also be educated about what they're using. But these guidelines will kind of help across the board, and obviously we'll keep writing articles and continue the education. And we've had posters at a couple different conferences, and we'll be doing more of that. And I think it's really important to get the word out in as many places as we can, and maybe we'll be able to have a formal workshop on it one day. But there's definitely a lot of interest generated about this. And even, for example, there's going to be a dry eye day on the Hill in July. And not only will TFOS be presenting the DEWS 2 findings, but we're most likely going to be having posters, research posters about dry eye on show. So I think it'd be a great way to bring the cosmetics and ocular surface disease up front on the Hill to get the Congress to start buzzing about the fact that more needs to be done. So education really, really can help here.
Yeah, I think education is huge, and I would love to see you ladies in the optometry schools as well. I think with your personalities, it will transfer over better to the students rather than just going to a lecture and just hearing the same thing over and over. You bring so many different aspects to the world of dry eyes.
So with talking about students, I know education-wise, Daryl, you're probably like this with me too. We didn't graduate that long ago, and I think we were told to use certain treatments that nowadays I consider to be not great advice, like baby shampoo for blepharitis. Are there any cringeworthy products that you hear people still recommending that you would just like to set the record straight? Let's change that.
Baby shampoo for sure. That's my own personal thing. Oh my goodness. No, don't use that. You know, I'm not sure that just squeezing lids doesn't cause harm in the end. We're talking about manual expression for MDD. I'm not a huge fan of that. If it were curative, if it fixed the problem, you wouldn't have to do it every 4 weeks.
Like popping a pimple.
We're talking about extremely delicate, specialized oil glands with these beautiful acinite. It reminds me of like the millet you hang in your parakeet cage and these beautiful little bubbles, little acinite around them. These are super delicate structures. And with all that pressure, you could be causing permanent changes. I'm not convinced it's a good practice, that it's safe, but the technology is not mainstream yet to test that idea. It's just a suspicion that I have that you're going to need the proliferation of confocal microscopy to really study the in vivo ultrastructural detail of these amazing glands. But I do have my suspicions that that may not be the best thing for the patient, especially in the long term.
The thing that I think that we were taught in school that I don't agree with either is manually teaching the patient to manually express after warm compresses. So I have a big problem with that, because now you've heated the surface of the eye, and you were telling patients to push against their eye to try to milk the meibomian out of their glands at home, which could be very damaging to the cornea once it's heated like that. You have to really even be careful with all the external heat sources that you are recommending to your patients. So that's something that I hear recommended sometimes still that I don't agree with.
I completely agree. We're offering Lipiflow at my practice now, and I'll just due to the price, patients will research online and they're like, well, why won't you just manually express me? And refuse to do it. I think it's a pro-inflammatory issue as well. I could physically damage the gland, and I know I'll increase gland inflammation by mashing on them, which could cause them to clog right back over, doesn't make as much sense when you break it down to the patient why that's not their best option. And I know, obviously, that's cheaper than LipiFlow. So a patient's going to sometimes be looking at price, but we have to really educate them on why a treatment that's not damaging their glands would probably be a better option.
And it's actually a great segue into this whole aesthetics and dry eye, because there's so much going on that's happening in aesthetics that we're learning from. So take IPL, intense pulse light, for example, done in dermatology, kind of found out by chance that these patients were getting ocular surface improvement. Another new area is radio frequency and heating the skin really around the eye to get rid of wrinkles and crow's feet. And again, seeing some improvement with dry eye symptoms. So this is where a lot of practices, and I know Laura has a lot more experience using IPL in her practice, but I have patients that I co-manage with for IPL when I feel like it's needed after LipiFlow or sometimes even before LipiFlow. But it's interesting to see how these aesthetic procedures can help, you know, the ocular surface as well.
Yeah, Whitney Hauser did a poster on using this technology for dry eye disease, and the details of their findings escape me. And it was a small study, but it was an interesting pilot study, and it's encouraging. It warrants more investigation. The opportunity, since we're talking about devices and aesthetics for managing dry eye disease, I think this is an untapped new world that has to be proven safe and efficacious, of course. But I think IPL has some great early data and promise. I'm excited to explore some of the radio frequency story. And then there's the role of fillers and injectables. So what I've found is that just using a filler to change the negative vectors on somebody's midface can support that lower lid enough, just a quarter of a millimeter, maybe a half a millimeter, and that can make a difference in the completeness of a person's blink and alleviate their dry eye symptoms. So it's what I'm finding, what I really appreciate as a dry eye disease nerd, is that it is so highly multifactorial. There's much to be explored. Each patient is different, and we're getting more and more tools all the time. The cosmetics piece is an important piece of it, which is why we're here today.
Do you think there's a future where an eye care office would have an aesthetic service with an aesthetician, maybe even potentially within their office?
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of working towards here as we expand our clinic into the fall. I'm hoping to try to figure a little bit of that out before the end of 2017. So hopefully, yes.
It's a whole new frontier.
Yeah, and it's, you know, kind of exciting because you can develop new relationships along the way. In our area, there's a lot of cosmetic centers. Actually, some of the women that work in those centers come in to us for exams. And it's kind of surprising to even see who's ordering their product line. So patients are going into these dermatology practices for, you know, better skin, sometimes with eye problems and eye concerns. And the person, at least in one of our local areas, ordering what they use as facial cleansers, under eye creams, is just kind of a person that's working the front desk, you know, or maybe an esthetician. It's not even a doctor. And there's a big area there of concern because we know that these anti-aging eye creams oftentimes contain retinol. And there's a lot of concern about that near the meibomian glands, these delicate structures that Laura was talking about earlier. There's a lot of proof that oral vitamin A through Accutane actually damages and kills the glands to the point of no return. So retinol applied near and around the eye to reverse wrinkles is really concerning, but they really have no idea of that at all. So kind of shows that there's even not just collaboration with MD ophthalmology, but MDs in our areas, whether it's dermatology, rheumatology, there's so much, you know, room for collaboration and education and that elevation, like Laura was talking about.
I find that to be true quite a bit, Leslie. I totally agree with you, that the disconnect between what dermatology thinks what's good for skin is very different than what's good for eyes. And Accutane is a perfect example of that. When I have a discussion with dermatology, they're shocked that Accutane is permanently damaging to meibomian glands. I'm like, well, here's a picture I can show you of when we have this amazing imaging capacity with LipiScan to look and keratograph and all those good things, to actually look at the anatomy and see the consequence. I have a friend of mine who, as an adult, 30-year-old adult, I have actually my meibomian gland images of him before and after he started Accutane, and there was an abrupt change. I haven't scanned him since he quit the Accutane, but we know that this is a significant problem, and that's just getting started. The original thought was along the lines of what's in that cosmetics jar. Anti-aging, you know, people stop thinking as soon as you say, look younger, look better. They stop thinking, and that's really unfortunate. We want to change that. Read your cosmetics label with the same passion that you read your food labels, because what's in there absolutely matters. The retinols are just the beginning of what's bad in those eye creams. The parabens are estrogenic, and those have negative impacts on the biochemistry of normal meibom production. The preservatives are directly toxic to the meibomian gland surface. Some of those are formaldehyde off-gassing preservatives, and you'll never recognize them on the label. They come in these really complicated Franken-ingredient names. We have a list. We have a little poster outreach in our latest issue of our latest article installment in Advanced Ocular Care that will hopefully simplify some of the messaging and outreaching and resources for our colleagues in talking with patients. But that's just the beginning. Now we've got other things like neurotoxins in cream. And these are touted as Botox in a jar, but we're here to tell you that that's not a good thing for the ocular surface, because the meibomian glands are neurobiologically wired. And if you're putting a neurotoxin in there, you're limiting that normal, efferent, lacrimal functional unit impulse to a meibomian gland, and that has impacts on not only hormone enzyme upregulation inside the meibomian gland, but normal meibom production.
So, and that's a problem too, to Laura, to play up on that, because, for example, the other night I went to an opening of a new Sephora in Boston, and I love going into these department stores and Sephora and all these cosmetic counters and asking them questions, because you mentioned the Botox in a jar. They all get giddy when I say, oh, look at that chemical. Isn't that kind of like sort of Botox in a jar? Because you have to speak like they do. And they think it's fabulous. It's in eye creams. It's in eyeliner. It's in mascara. And if you have these neurotoxins being put everywhere around your eye, unbeknownst to the consumers, that's a bit of a challenge. So people really don't know. And then also you have back. For example, I know, Laura, would you like to explain what BAC is, or Leslie? That's a wonderful ingredient that's in makeup remover and also in eyeliner and mascara.
So benzalkonium chloride, BAK or BAC, as it's commonly abbreviated, is a common ophthalmic preservative, and you'll find it in wee concentrations in the eye drops that you prescribe. But we're talking tiny concentrations, like 0.015 to 0.005, really small. When you're talking about some liquid eye makeup removers, we suspect the ingredients are 1% and higher. And we know BAK is toxic to the epithelium of the cornea and the meibomian glands. So here becomes the problem. So the FDA labeling rules state that as long as your ingredient is less than 1% of total composition of product, you do not need to list it. It's listed. So by deduction, we know that the concentration is at least 1%, which is far more than you would ever dream of giving as an ophthalmic drop. And yet, patients are doing this to themselves every single day to remove their waterproof makeup. So that's one of the practical things that we talk about with our patients in our outreach and in our articles as well.
Well, I want to pick your brain. Do you guys have a product you do recommend just to help doctors listening jumpstart on good recommendations?
I think it's better not to mention any products in particular, because I think what we need to do is educate doctors and patients alike about the ingredients in the products that are worrisome, because there are so many products out there and they're not all evil, but they're not all good either. So I think it's best just to know what's in your product, just like Laura said, what's in your salad, what are you eating, and know what you're putting on your eyes and ask questions. But I don't think it's good to name a product at this time. I just think it's better to be educated and know what you're using.
So what about the trends of organic makeup or preservative-free makeup? Can you elaborate a little bit more about that?
Well, there's a trend in having organic, natural, vegan, gluten-free, animal friendly, good, who knows what out there for cosmetics. And you need to pay attention to that as well, because just as though it's purported as being organic or all natural, it does not mean that it is good for you. So again, know your products.
So like when someone mashes up blueberries to make mascara, not necessarily
yeah, mold after a day, right? So
which brings up another great point, Jen. I was really surprised to learn, you know, the beauty industry on YouTube. And that's actually where I first saw blueberry mascara. And that's where our youth is kind of turning to learn how to use makeup. They're not talking to their moms. They're talking to YouTube, or not really talking. They're watching these videos. It's one of the highest hits on YouTube, our beauty channels. It's a great opportunity because a lot of our patients are, you know, starting with us young. And so I talk to patients all the time. If I notice anything, if they're really kind of 12 and up where I am, or even if I have a suspicion that they might be doing it before, I just ask them during their exam. A big trend in that youth group is the waterline or the tight lining of their eyeliner, because to them, it's a great place to put mascara on that little shelf by your eyelashes. People have no idea that there's even a meibomian gland orifice, and just educating them to where those glands come and starting that conversation at a young age, I think can really help them long-term be able to, you know, keep their eyes healthy as they are using of cosmetics.
That scares me a lot, because I have a lot of young ladies come into my office looking at what the young ladies are buying as far as makeup goes, and what I see online as far as Instagram and stuff like that. That stuff is real cheap. So I'm pretty sure they have like the worst ingredients in that makeup versus someone that maybe buys something from like MAC.
Actually, Daryl, no.
Am I right? No, am I wrong?
You're wrong. I have to
well, you can't really go by that, Daryl.
You're a fallacy.
Am I?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cost does not seem to be a factor, and some of the higher end are using really interesting things. One of our favorites was crushed diamonds for exfoliating your skin. So let's put crushed diamonds or crushed rocks onto our face right near the eye and rub them around and hope that they don't get into the eye where they could do a lot of irritation. So I think that you can't, that's really the message is you can't, and even if you had a brand you loved, a mascara that you thought was going to be the most ocular surface friendly, you can't guarantee that they're not going to change the formulation on the product. You really every time actually have to really look at the ingredients and read them and see, did anything change? Because a lot of times they can change the formulation and you don't even realize it.
Yes, I wanted to add on to that, Leslie, that there's a list of things that do not equate to ocular surface friendliness. And they're, as Amy said, it's organic, vegan, natural, and even ophthalmologist tested. That does not mean that it's ocular surface friendly. Ophthalmologist tested, hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that, but you're going to see it on a lot of stuff, and it means almost nothing from a safety standpoint, especially long term. The other thing I wanted to point out is that the cost of your product does not confer any safety as well. There are some very reasonable price points, items that are much more ocular surface friendly, and sometimes we'll see very high-end, quote-unquote, products, and you look at the ingredient list, I'm like, oh, awesome, there's 9 offenders on that ingredient list. Fantastic. So clinically, here's how it translates. You'll get that person come in, could be young, it could be a mature woman, a beautiful older mature woman who quote unquote has refractory blepharitis. I have tried everything, and I'll look at them and I'll see that they're beautiful, and I'll see they're doing Botox and all kinds of other stuff, and I'll say, you know what, next I'm gonna start you on the appropriate therapy that you need, but I want you to bring in everything you're using next time you come in to visit. And they do, they'll bring in boxes of stuff, and I'll go through, I'm like, well, this is, how often do you use this product? Every single day. It's like, oh, well, that's part of your problem. And how I explain to my patient is that, listen, if you're a diabetic and I put you on an oral hypoglycemic agent, you can't still have the big gulp every day. That's not how this works. You have to stop doing the thing that's creating the problem. And that's the big Godzilla in the crib, is cosmetics is a huge contributor to the problem. Once I clean that up for my patient, my interventions work significantly better. These people get significantly better because they're not drinking the big gulp every single day.
So I want to switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about the world of lashes. That seems to be like the hottest thing out now. Ladies always coming in with these long lashes. I mean, they have some meek lashes, thin lashes. I mean, I hear everything. And I like, what should I be looking for when I'm in exam room examining patients, or ladies, I should say, and they have these fake lashes?
The biggest thing I learned this year through our work is the importance of the lash. I mean, I knew the importance of the lash for cosmetics. Obviously, being a woman myself, I have been guilty of mascara, but have never actually personally tried extensions. But the lash is ideally supposed to be one third the width of our eye. And when it's that ideal length, it's actually diverting wind away from the eye and debris, allergens away from the eye. And as soon as you extend the lash beyond that, which is what we do with these false eyelashes, eyelash serums that are growing the lash, mascara that is stiffening and lengthening the lash, we're actually creating a wind tunnel. So we're actually now pulling the wind in toward the ocular surface to help create an evaporative, a dry eye. So really, the best conversation to have is avoidance, I think, of extensions. I mean, not just because of the length of the lash, but also how are they adhering them with a glue? A glue that's not me, not ocular
surface. Once again, it goes back
friendly
to the formaldehyde. Yeah. You have the formaldehyde story. Again.
Yeah.
I think every eye care professional should have in their office a frog in a jar. And just
we
keep
actually
it there.
Tweeted, well, from the dry eye makeup Twitter handle the other day, I did an actual graphic of a petrified frog floating in formaldehyde and a woman wearing bright green eye makeup to kind of complement the formaldehyde look. And you have the image. It's like, imagine the frog and the formaldehyde, and imagine your lids on formaldehyde. They're the same thing. They're petrified. So you have to talk about the glue as well. It isn't just the mascara or the length. You have to talk about the glue and the adhesives and all that nasty stuff that they're putting on there. So,
and then, Laura, what about the blepharitis that comes
along
with
the
extensions?
Oh, I love that, because people don't want to scrub off their expensive lash extensions. So you get this massive accumulation of crud right at the lash base, and it's disgusting. It's really impressive. What
you should tell your patients it's the same as not changing their underwear. You know, you wouldn't do that. So,
right.
Oh gosh.
Yuck.
I think the divas should get up with some of the biggest social media stars that do makeup and do some type of collaboration to educate them on, you know, some of the downsides of some of the stuff or products that they're using. I think that'll make a big hit, and you'll have these patients coming into the office inquiring more about what should they use for their eyes, why are my eyes red, and just have more knowledge about what's going on, because social media is very powerful, and if you could connect with the right minds, I mean, you could go very far with it.
We're definitely trying to do that.
Thank you for what you're doing for us today. We love your forum. This is super awesome.
So, ladies, it was great having you on the podcast today. What's the best way for our listeners and followers to get in touch with you if they have a question or just want to learn more about the Dry Eye Diva movement?
Well, there is the TFOS website, and we have the blog, and we also will be doing the Dry Eye Diva guidelines, which will be coming out from TFOS. But Laura, Leslie, and I all have Twitter accounts, and we tweet almost daily with factoids and tidbits about cosmetics and ocular surface disease. So you can follow us on Twitter as well.
Thank everybody so much for your time today. I know I learned a ton, and I'm about to go wipe out all my mascara.
Jennifer, I'm going to throw away all my wife's makeup as well. So if you don't see me tomorrow, you know why. She killed me.
No, you can buy her new makeup.
I would start with your – buy her new makeup. And, Daryl, check out your facial cleanser and see what harm that might be doing.
I know. I mean, normally I just use whatever my wife gives me, but I got to go check it out now. Thank you, divas. Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast, and remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.